Once upon a time, in a magic land, a Christmas celebration was held.
Happy holidays, everybody!
Merry Christmas!
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls,
Merry Christmas!
The Magic Kingdom proudly presents our holiday celebration.
WDW Radio,
your information station.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the WDW Radio Show, your Walt Disney World Information Station. I am your host, Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 467. And I'm here once again, not only to help you have the best possible vacation experience when you come to Walt Disney World, but I also want to try and help bring you a little bit of Disney magic wherever you are. Whether you're stuck at work or stuck in the cold, I want to bring you some audio with the podcast and videos, the blog, live broadcasts every Wednesday on Facebook, my books, audio tours, and more. You can find everything over at wdwradio.com. Christmas and the spirit of the season has always been celebrated in the Disney parks, beginning in Disneyland in 1955 and continuing on to Walt Disney World just 2 months after the park opened in 1971. And through the years, a variety of celebrations, shows, and spectacles have been featured in the parks, hotels, and throughout the resort. Well, this week, we're going to look back at the history of Christmas in Walt Disney World, from the very first Mickey's Very Merry Christmas Party and Candlelight Processionals to Bears, Osborne Lights, Santa, the Glory, and Pageantry, lights, celebrities, music, characters, and everything else that make up the jolly holidays at Walt Disney World. I'm then going to ask you to share your memories with me for the show. I'll then have the answer to our last Walt Disney World trivia question of the week and pose a new challenge for your chance to win a Disney prize package. Then stay tuned to the end of the show as I'll have information about our next Meet of the Month in Walt Disney World as we celebrate the holidays together, The Purge, your voicemails, and more. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of the WDW Radio Show.
That's supposed to be my song.
Huh?
Look, Melvin, I'm the deer. I got the red nose, so I get to sing.
Ain't we gone through all this before?
Well, I don't see why he always gets to sing.
Hold the phone there, boys. Where's your Christmas spirit? Sorry, folks. Gomer, let's show 'em how it's done.
If I asked you when the most wonderful time of year to visit Walt Disney was, for some people, any time is the best time, or to quote, now is the time, now is the best time. But for me, the best time to visit usually revolves around some food-related special event like Food and Wine or Flower and Garden. But for a lot of people, the holidays truly are the most wonderful time of year. There is something special about the parks, the way they're decorated. There's something, I think, unquantifiable and intangible in the air. Maybe it's the smell of hot chocolate. Maybe it's the vision of snow falling on Main Street or the music in the background. But I and many other people love Walt Disney World and the Disney parks during the Christmas holidays. And I think it's a very, very different type of experience that you will get other than any other time of year. And Christmas has always been celebrated in the Disney parks, even going back to Disneyland's first year in 1955 with decorations and trees and even carolers. And of course, that tradition continued when Walt Disney World opened in 1971. And each year, it has gotten grander and more elaborate, and I think really more joyful as the holiday celebrations have spread beyond the parks to the resorts and the shopping and downtown districts as well. So this week, we're going to get cozy, we're going to gather around the fire together, and share stories of the history of Christmas at Walt Disney World. And joining me is a man who, like me, is round and jolly, loves a good story, and who shares his gifts with others through the stories that he tells. No, it's not Santa Claus, Buddy the Elf, or Emmett Otter, but none other than author, raconteur, and friend, Jolly Jimmy Korkus.
Oh. I'm sitting here with my hot cocoa and my roasting chestnuts, which is very painful this time of year. But I think you're absolutely right, Lou, that going to a Disney theme park is a magical experience. It really is. And I know that that's become a cliche, but there's something even more magical when it's over the holiday season. And maybe that's because many of the things that we associate with the holidays, you know, getting together with family, you know, wonderful memories, things like that, align so closely with Disney traditions. And as you were saying, too, Walt made sure that even that very first Christmas in Disneyland in December of 1955, that there were elements of Christmas there. And interestingly enough, those grew and became so important and so intrinsic that when Walt Disney World opened 45 years ago in 1971, a lot of those traditions, candlelight processional, the Christmas parade, all that was translated wholesale to the brand new Magic Kingdom.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. Like, Christmas has always been celebrated, you know, even in Walt Disney World's first year, not with the three. It wasn't the coming of the three kings. It was the three P's, the parades, parties, and processionals, the same things that they had in Disneyland. But and look, I think just as a quick aside, before we move forward, I want to step back a second because so many of these things really come from Walt. And, you know, Walt himself, personally, he loved Christmas. He celebrated, obviously, very humbly as a child. And even as he was able, when he was able to spoil his children, he didn't. And I know in your in one of your books, you have a chapter dedicated specifically to Walt and Christmas. Mm-hmm. But I think that's why it was important for Walt to celebrate this holiday in his parks.
Yes, I think so. Because he loved people, and yes, the chapter you're mentioning is Santa Walt, which is in one of the Vault of Walt books there, I think volume two. And basically, Walt never looked forward to getting presents because he really didn't get them as a kid, but he loved giving presents. And I think he felt giving something extra at Disneyland over the holiday season was important. So, you know, you have carolers and people coming to Disneyland. They're not paying any extra to see these people in authentic Dickens costumes around there. There was a huge Christmas tree to the left side of the entrance of Sleeping Beauty Castle. There was even a Christmas tree on the forward deck of the Mark Twain. And again, you know, all of the lights and then window displays, which over the years became more and more elaborate, especially on Main Street. And so I think Walt felt a responsibility that people were giving up part of their holiday season to drive out to Anaheim, so he wanted to make it a little special for them, other than the fact that Walt just enjoyed it himself, had a little Christmas tree in his own apartment over the firehouse there. And if you're going to have a Christmas tree, one of the best places to have it is over a firehouse. It's probably one of the safest things.
Well, what I love too, Jim, is, you know, you have to remember, you know, Walt Disney World opens in October of 71. So you have just about, I mean, it's not even 2 months really before they start their, you know, their Christmas tradition, you know, almost sort of on day one. And obviously, remember, it's just Magic Kingdom back then. But they had parades and they had decorations and they had Main Street with the giant Christmas tree and poinsettias and pansy. And in Town Square, they had that giant Christmas tree and the Wonderland of Wax, which eventually became the Holiday Corner, had Christmas mm-hmm. decorations in there. And even the windows, much like we look forward to now as the Emporium windows change over, that happened in that very first year as well.
And again, Lou, I think a lot of times people forget that even though the park opened October 1st, 1971, it barely opened October 1st, 1971. There were a lot of things that were incomplete. This was all considered phase one. There were some things that they had not gotten around to building yet. There was not enough time. There was not enough money to do that. And some of the things that did open really weren't complete. And so you're right. And so here, you know, literally about 2 months later, you're having Christmas decorations. I don't know if any of your listeners are old enough to remember, but December 1971 in the Contemporary Resort in the Grand Canyon Concourse, they had a huge artificial Christmas tree, because again, artificial Christmas trees, that's the future, and the contemporary is the future. But this artificial Christmas tree was done up like a, I guess I would describe it like a layer cake, but each succeeding layer got smaller. So it became this cone shape. But each layer was literally just streams of green tinsel. Right. And on the top was the futuristic star, which looked like, you know, an outer space circular globe round ball satellite with all of these different length spikes, you know, coming out of it. Because, my gosh, it's hard for us to realize right now, but the Contemporary was like, oh my gosh, that's not just the Contemporary, that's the future. And, we didn't realize that when the Contemporary opened, this is the future, but they didn't have elevator access up to the monorail. So that was the future.
But we had our gray spandex jumpsuits like Buck Rogers, and we had our metallic green Christmas tree.
When Epcot opened, it was excruciating polyester costumes of torture, right?
But keep in mind, that's what
Epcot stood for.
And so, that tree, but wait, so Jimmy.
So even though there are similar traditions in 71, because for the candlelight processional, that's being held at the train station, because it was held at the train station in Disneyland, and they brought out Dr. Charles Hirt, who created the candlelight processional at Disneyland in 1958 and kept running it every year there. They brought him out, so for a couple of years he was out here at Christmas, staging the exact same candlelight processional on the train station steps at Walt Disney World. And again, the processional was only, you know, two nights. You know, we tend to forget these things, that things started very small. When Mickey's Very Merry Christmas Party debuted in 1989, it was for two nights only, because there was like, would Disney guests really pay an additional ticket to come see this? And when it was such a huge hit, then the following year in 1990, and they realized this was a huge hit, they expanded it to a third night. And these days, what are we getting? A month worth of nights? I don't know anymore now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you think back to that first year, again, they did it, you know, much of the same things that we have now, we had back then, but on a different scale. So when you do think about things like, for example, the candlelight processional, there weren't, you know, the at the very beginning, we think about the candlelight processional now as not just the choir of cast members, but really about the celebrities. So at the beginning, there was two nights, and there were high school choirs with 900 to 1,000 students. But the narrator who told the story of the first Christmas was not necessarily a celebrity. It wasn't until about 1960, 61, I think, they had the first celebrity over in Disneyland and at Disney World, Rock Hudson was the very first. So now, listen, we say Rock Hudson and we laugh because we know who Rock Hudson is. But a lot of people going, Rock who? Like, who is? And Rock Hudson wasn't just for like 1 year, but I think 6 years leading up until the mid-80s.
Right. And in fact, he did, I think, two over at Disneyland as well, too. And yes, Rock Hudson was one of those big, glamorous movie stars, you know, where women would, you know, scream and faint because he was so handsome and so rugged. And he'd be in romantic comedies with Doris Day, or he'd be in westerns and all of that. And it's interesting how short, you know, our memories are that, you know, we don't, time just seems to blur, together. You know, the first, televised Disney Christmas parade out at Walt Disney World didn't feature Regis Philbin. You know, I think it was Joan London and Mike Douglas, who was a talk show host, and Regis popped up the next year, but as a on the street correspondent. You know, it took several years for him to, but I think a lot of people grew up and just remembered that no, Regis Philbin was the host of the Walt Disney World Christmas parade. You know, well,
we almost sort of remember it always
evolved.
We always, you know, I think for a lot of us too, who are a little bit older, it almost seems
of
like
a certain age. Those of us right. who are of a certain age,
it always seems like the Christmas.
I'm of a certain age. I remember when Disney would bring live Christmas trees and put them, you know, in Town Square. So.
But we always sort of remember, like, well, there was always a Christmas, there was always a Disney Christmas, you know, party on TV, but it wasn't until like 93, I think, the first party and live, quote unquote, telecast happened.
Mm-hmm. And actually it was a live telecast to begin with. Nowadays, what they do, because they're worried about, you know, weather, they're worried about the commitments that celebrities have who are going to be lip syncing in the parade. that it gets filmed sometimes the end of November, yeah, or the very first week of December. Have you ever been to any of those filmings, Lou?
I have walked by the filmings because people line up very, very early to get their spot on Main Street. And it's, you know, not to sort of spoil, but it's a process that takes all day. They don't just run it once and it, you know, they move things forward. They pull things back.
I don't think people realize that it's not a straight parade.
Right. It's not done in one take.
Of the parade, and then they'll stop and they'll move it back and they'll bring it in again. And then the director will yell at you to capture some what are called wild shots with people screaming and yelling, but at nothing in particular.
There's nothing going on.
But then through the magic of editing, when you see it on TV, it's like, oh, here comes this float with a singer I've never heard of, but the entire crowd is going crazy.
Well, I have been there for some of those things, and I've watched some of the performers, and there is something neat and exciting about being there for the taping. For some people, it's the idea.
I think you should do it once, like right. being in Times Square for New Year's Eve. You should do it at least once, so you've had that experience. I learned long ago, being a California boy, that getting up at the crack of darkness to go down to Colorado Boulevard to stand on the street to see the Rose Parade. That's exciting once, maybe twice, but after that, it's like, I can sleep in and then turn it on TV and, you know, have my cinnamon rolls and hot cocoa and be in my slippers.
I do, I will tell you that I do like, and it still is tradition, Christmas morning, you get up and you open the presents that Santa left behind, and you do like to still watch the Christmas party and the Christmas Day parade. And one of the things that I think is really neat, Jim, is stuff that we see in the parade now and as part of the party now, taking the modern celebrities out of there, when you go back to things like my favorite parts are the toy soldiers and the reindeer the bands and the Disney characters. Those go back to the very first parades, and those and I sort of like that from a historical perspective. That yes, they may have evolved over time, but those are, we talk about Christmas traditions. That has been part of the Walt Disney World Christmas tradition from day one. The interesting thing that I found when I was doing my research was that in 1971, the Magic Kingdom closed at 6 p.m., the same thing on Christmas Day. They'd be like, what? We're open till 3. Who are you kidding?
Well, you know, again, and it took me a while, because I am a former Walt Disney World cast member. It took me a while to realize, I thought, why is Christmas Day so crowded? Why is Thanksgiving Day so crowded? Why aren't these people home with their families, you know? And it was explained to me, these people are on vacation. They can't. This is their family. Being Disney is now part of their extended family.
And I was going to say, you know, it's part of the tradition.
And so that's why you're there. And yeah, I love those tin soldiers. Those debuted back in 61. Those were designed by a good friend of mine who unfortunately passed away, Bill Justice, who was an animator and an Imagineer. And he came up with the designs for those along with his friend, Exitencio. And the reason for those toy soldiers was because they had been working on the stop-motion miniature ones for the movie Babes in Toyland. And so they took those exact same designs and just, you know, exploded them. And Exitencio and Bill came up with those the goofy-looking reindeer, you know, the ones right. with the tongues hanging out. You know, obviously, material used to create those costumes have improved and changed over the years, but the spirit and the basic design remains the same. And I think the point that you're trying to get at is that initial spirit of Christmas that was there at Disneyland since it opened and Walt Disney World since it opened still exists today. And so when we go to the parks, you know, this holiday season, it's some of that tradition. And not all traditions are good, but I think this tradition is great. Some of that tradition, you know, it is there, and that infuses our reactions to what we're seeing there.
Well, and, you know, I want to touch on one thing, because we were sort of almost laughing like a couple of old men about, you know, the quote-unquote celebrities when we watch the Christmas Day parade now maybe are not as relatable to us, some of the singers and performers, you know, but celebrities as part of the candlelight processional and as part of the party and tradition have been around since day one, right? So I'm going to read some names that you and I can probably relate to. Some people couldn't, but Rock Hudson was a big deal. Cary Grant was a big deal in 1972. Dean Jones, you should obviously know the Disney connection there. Pat Boone, Walter Cronkite in 1988, McLean Stevenson and George Kennedy. But the reason why I wanted to bring this up is because,
you know, and all of these celebrities gave outstanding performances. It wasn't as if they were slumming.
They wanted,
you know,
to be there, right? They wanted to be there.
Park. This was something serious and important, and I think that's reflected in the narrators that we have today. You know, and I think some of your listeners probably have some favorites, whether it's like Neil Patrick Harris or whatever. You know, and at one time Neil Patrick Harris was best known for being Doogie Howser. Who would have guessed, right? You never know. But you know, this was serious. This was important. And the cast members who get involved, and the cast members who are part of the cast choir for Candlelight Processional. I can tell you from being an ex-cast member how important and how seriously people took being a part of that experience. It really is transcendent.
Well, and I think the celebrities do too. And I'm specifically trying to lead you to two stories that I want you to tell, right? Because we talk about how so many of these, I mean, we're talking A-list celebrities, and maybe to sort of make it more relative, you know, James Earl Jones was a celebrity narrator. But there's two really interesting stories that I know you tell that actually happened in back-to-back years. And the first was in 1970 with Charlton Heston and the weather, and the following year with John Wayne being sick.
Well, sometimes, Lou, I get tired of listening to my own voice. So why don't you start with one of these? Why don't you take the Charlton Heston one there?
So I'm feel like I'm telling your story, but in 1970,
that's the whole point, is that when I tell a story, stories need to be shared kept alive, and one of the things that I particularly enjoy is hearing people tell those stories back, because then hearing them from a different perspective, because there'll be different things that you will emphasize, and you know, or some little. What do I want to say? Some little Mangello touch.
Well, I want to listen. I agree with you, and I think the stories, you know, I said, I think in one of the introductions I wrote for one of your books, you know, we are all cavemen, right? We're all storytellers, but I think it's also important to credit the source that you originally heard from. So this story,
yes.
If I've gotten it right, I've heard it from Jim Corcus. If I got it wrong, I read it somewhere else. But in 19...
Well, at least you've got Jim Corcus here now who has such great respect for you, who will say, now, Lou,
that's close.
The way I heard it was.
All right. So tell me if this is as true. Maybe I'll use as little detail as possible so I don't mess it up. But in 1970, you know, the weather is not always perfect. And these rain clouds are coming in as he's getting ready to narrate it, which, again, he wanted to do. This is something he asked that he really wanted to do. And allegedly, Charlton was to say, listen, if I can part the Red Sea, then I can stop it from raining. So don't you worry. And in Heston fashion, it did not rain.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely true. And again,
oh,
it's
by the way,
kids,
Charlton Heston was Moses, right? He was Moses.
What Charlie Ridgway used to call Walt weather. And I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but that came about, of course, with the 1960 Winter Olympics up in Squaw Valley, and you know, it was snowing so hard that you know, the conductor and the conductor was Charles Hurt, by the way, from Candlelight Processional, could not see the chorus at all. And so it was like, well, this is going to be telecast. Should we move all of this indoors? And Walt said, no, you know, because if we do that, you know, a lot of these kids who were in the chorus, and they you know, had to earn money to come out here, and all of this, you know, they won't get a chance to be on camera. He says, we're gonna wait. And then what happened is, just before the telecast, the weather cleared up. It was beautiful. And so they filmed, and then the moment the ceremonies closed, roughly about an hour later, one of the worst snowstorms in the world came. And so Charlie Ridgway, who did publicity for Disney, called that Walt weather, that when there was an important Disney event, basically what happens is the weather will clear up. so that can happen. And Charlton Heston was quite a character. You know, we've talked about this before, that when he was writing his signature in his handprint block in front of the Chinese Theater at Disney Hollywood Studios, that as he was signing that, one of his fans called out to him, and so he looked up to acknowledge that, and then he went back to write, and he left out one of the letters in his name. You know, and it's like, holy cow.
Right, he's Charlton. You know? He's Charlton Heston.
Well, and so you can do that. And, you know, you've mentioned that before. I wonder how many, and I hate to call them kids, but I wonder how many people today remember Charlton Heston or can name some of the films that he was in. You know, of course, Ben-Hur is famous, but I always remember him from Soylent Green and Omega Man. So, wow. Yeah.
Hey, look, he's always going to be Moses to me, Charlton Heston. He's always going to be...
Well, you know, that's a great thing to do. Well, listen, I've been jabbering a while. You did a great job on that last story. Let's have you do the John Wayne one here too, and then I'll add in some footnotes. Go ahead.
So
you got that just right on. But I wish you had done it in Charlton Heston's voice.
Well, I thought about doing the John Wayne voice, you know, my pilgrim voice.
Well, pilgrim, give it a shot here.
Listen.
What we got.
I still haven't done my 20,000 Leagues James Mason voice. I'm not going to start off by doing a really bad John Wayne.
Well, listen, and now you know all of the box people are going to come in and go, we want to hear James, even though they don't know who James Mason is.
I know. They don't know. They're like, who are these old guys? Heston? Well, John Wayne? James Mason? Who are? Listen, kids, all you need to know is John Wayne, Duke Morrison, whatever you want to call him, Marion Morrison.
You know, thank heavens you have a 13-year-old daughter, so she keeps you up to date with some of the new actors and actresses and celebrities that are out there. You know, she mentions them, and I'm sure you had to keep up to date so that you know who she's talking about or who she's interested in.
Well, it's worse when I say a name of who I think somebody that's current is now, and she looks at me like I've got, like, who? What? What are you talking about? But all right, so John Wayne, famous Western star, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, Rio Bravo, Quiet Man, The Shooters, tons. I mean, I don't even know how many, 140, 150 films, somewhere around there?
At least, you know, he did all of those... little B movie westerns for smaller studios like Republic, because my dad was a huge Western movie fan, so you know, by golly, you know, that's what he wanted to watch, and so on Saturday afternoon sometimes I'd sit there with my dad and we'd watch that.
Well, if you're still not sure, he's the cowboy in The Great Movie Ride on the left-hand side. How's that?
There you go. See, that's where we should have gone first. So the John Wayne story is, what, in the 70s here, right?
Right, I think 71. 70s? He was very sick. He had, he had pneumonia, or he had a really bad cough, and he decides to do it anyway. And the reason why was not for any sort of personal reason. He's like, look, I just don't want to let all these kids down that came mm-hmm. out to hear me say it. And I think, you know, that's one. It's a testament to him and his, again, these celebrities weren't doing it for the PR and publicity. They were there because they wanted to be there. And I think it's true.
And we should clear this up. We said that Rock Hudson did it in 71. It was 71. At Walt Disney World, John Wayne 71 at Disneyland. So
yeah.
So, my gosh, you know, what for? By golly, I remember the good old days when there used to be the Osborne Spectacle of Dancing Lights.
Wait,
don't know what you're missing.
So wait, just to sort of fill in the gap here, because you're saying, well, wait a minute, you're telling me that at Walt Disney World, the Candlelight Processional used to be in Magic Kingdom. It moved to Epcot, not in, not when it first opened. It didn't move to Epcot until 1993, and they started doing...
That's right, simply because they needed to have a bigger venue. You know, it was so difficult to, you know, try to find a room on Main Street, you know, and try to take a look at the, you know, they did the train station because it's a raised area. But, you know, even then it's difficult to see. So,
yeah. So,
you know, and the older I get, the more I'd like to sit down. So I'm glad they moved it to Epcot.
Well, not only did they move it, but remember, we're talking about the Candlelight being two nights. Now, once it moves to Epcot, it's twice a night. It's 15 nights. And then the following year, they double it. It's now 30 nights. And then I believe in 2010, 2011, somewhere around there, it's three times a night for 35 nights.
Yeah.
So that is a lot. But it... Look, any night that you go, it's completely full, and people stand online for hours in order to see their favorite performers.
And stand in the back there, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, trying to peer in. Because, you know, it's a unique experience. I don't think I'm trying to rack my brain. I can't remember any other amusement park, amusement venue that had something similar to that. You really become immersed in the entire experience there. The sound, the lights, and more importantly, the reactions of the people there as well. You know, they're enthusiastic, but they're still respectful. You know, you talk about the Food and Wine Festival and things like that, and I know when they have when they had rocking concerts at the American Gardens Theater, and they had somebody like Davy Jones perform from the Monkees, and I remember seeing these 20-something young women becoming so embarrassed because their mothers were all in the front rows and standing up wanting to run to the stage, you know, and not understanding, you know, why this is happening. But, you know, you don't get that with the Candlelight Processional. People treat it very respectfully. And when you think of the vast number of people and the vast number of opportunities for something inappropriate to happen, and it never does because people really become part of that experience.
Yeah, and so you started to you hinted to, and we can even sort of get into some of the things that are kind of extinct. You know, through the years and through the decades, there were a lot of holiday offerings that came and went, and I think the first one is one that you hinted at, and it's still the one that maybe stings for people because it's so close, and that was the Osborne Family Spectacle of Dancing Lights, which I think was something that was not just beloved by people, Jim, but something that people really looked forward to and specifically made trips out to come and see.
And yes, I'm of that certain age, so I remember when it was on Residential Street, and that was quite a wonderful experience. If you're walking, and it's like you're actually walking down a neighborhood, you know, and that neighbors have decorated their lawn chairs, and they've done all of these things for that to happen. And you know, I went to the Streets of America, I think some of that intimacy, some of that mm-hmm. charm was lost, but I was still glad all of that was there. Yeah, William Jennings Osborne, quite a character, you know, and Do you want to tell the story of how he put up those lights for his little daughter Breezy?
So, Jimmy, come here by the fire and let me tell you a tale of Jenning Hawthorne. Let's go back to 1994, 1995. You've got the Christmas parties at the Magic Kingdom. You've got the very mm-hmm. Merry Christmas Parade. You've got...
And they're all making money. It's a business, so it's good to make money.
At Epcot, you've got Felicia Rashad giving performances of the Candlelight Processional. And over in Little Rock, Arkansas... Jennings Osborne, in really sort of a gift to his family, a gift to his daughter, starts putting up Christmas lights on his home. The Christmas lights, much like our waistlines, continues to grow year after year. So much so, long story longer, it ends up becoming something that is according to his neighbors, a nuisance. So Jennings is mm-hmm. like, okay, that's fine. I'll just buy the house next door and I'll just keep my thing growing. It ends up going to the Arkansas Supreme Court, who rules against the Osbournes and orders them to take down their decorations. Insert sad thematic music here.
Right.
Disney comes to the rescue. It would not be a year without a Santa Claus. They save the display. They find a home for the lights over at the Disney MGM Studios. They send a convoy of trucks to pick up 2 million plus Christmas lights and one accidental black cat. And in 1995, the Osborne family spectacle of dancing lights thrills fans for 20 years before it left just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, and 2015. It was January 6th, 2016. They extended it because it was the last year before they were going to tear down all of that area for Star Wars land. I met Jennings Osborne, and I met his daughter, Breezy. Allison Brienne, but her nickname was Breezy. And basically, when she was 6 years old in 1986, you know, he asked her, and this is a hugely wealthy man, asked her, you know, what do you want for Christmas? Expecting, you know, she'd have some doll, maybe she'd want a pony, you know, things like that. And it was her dad was so busy making money that she just wanted to spend time with her dad, putting up Christmas tree lights on the house. And so 1986, that first year, they put up 1,000 lights, which was, you know, pretty amazing. And he just had so much fun doing that, that you're absolutely right. He kept adding lights. And yeah, when the neighbors complained, he bought the house next to him. And when they still kept complaining, he bought the other house next to him. So he had three houses right next to each other with that. And in fact, the lights were so bright that pilots could see them from 80 miles away. and so it was talking about giving people credit. It was John Phelan, who's a terrific Disney show director. He worked with his boss was Bruce Laval. And they said, well, let's call this guy and see, you know, because Laval had seen it on CNN, this whole story. And Osborne had gotten offers from other cities to do this. And in fact, later Osborne decorated, you know, other things, including Graceland, believe it or not, with Christmas tree lights, all free of charge. But it was 4 18-wheel moving vans that brought all the stuff down to Walt Disney World November 4th, 1995. Now, the reason I emphasize November 4th, 1995 is because
the Christmas lights should have been up already.
The debut was November 24th. Right. So you got 20 days. So Osborne, being the guy that he was, he paid for technicians to come down and help the Disney people, you know, put all of this stuff up. And he did not ask for a single penny.
Yeah.
either for the lights or for the use of his name. He didn't even demand that his name be used, but they did. But what would happen is he and his family would come down each year for about a week during the Christmas season, and Disney would put him up at the Grand Floridian and, you know, comp him into all of the parks. And for at least one night of them being out here, Osborne and his daughter would come to what was then Disney MGM Studios, talk about things that pass away, and they would turn on the lights that one night. And speaking about, you know, oh my gosh, you know, things that have, you know, glowed away here. I'm old enough to remember when you used to go see the Osborne spectacle of lights, and they weren't dancing lights to begin with. Eventually they became dancing lights when they installed, you know, all these dimmer relays and control switches so they could be choreographed to a musical score. But Disney would give away special glasses. Mm-hmm. And the first year you put them on, and when you looked at lights, you could see angels. And what was super cool about this is, of course, I brought my glasses home because you want to have those Disney souvenirs. And I looked at my own Christmas tree, and you could see the angels in the lights. And then the next year, I don't know whether it was because of religious controversy or whatever. You never know sometimes why some decisions were made. But the next year, you got glasses that showed you snowflakes. Mm-hmm. when you looked at the lights. Did you have that experience, Lou?
I did, and I remember it was the first time I had ever seen something like that, which we see a lot, right? You know, now we see the first nighttime drone show here. We're going to end up seeing that elsewhere, but that's the first time I saw, you know, these paper 3D glasses
that could be technologically engineered to allow you to do. Well, you know, it's the little things that, you know, and again, if you've never seen it before, it's new to you. It was the first time I had seen, you know, that. And I was thinking, you know, because I had had bad experiences with 3D glasses and things like that. And
yeah, but Jim, that was like the 50s when you were going to the movies and watching The Blob. So it's very, very different now. So.
memories.
So
know?
I want to just while we're talking know, about
now you've got me all worked up. I'm going to have to. I guess it's it'll probably be on sale. I can probably go buy a Rock Hudson movie and a Charlton Heston movie, and now they're Christmas movies for me for me to enjoy. But no, the Festival of Light, my gosh, it was so packed. Even when it was on Residential Street, you know, you were all moving in the same direction. If you tried to go against the flow, good luck.
Right, and it was a wide street. It was a lot of space.
And on Streets of America, it was, you know, person to person packed there. And that canopy of lights, you know, that you can be under and really be immersed when the music goes off. That was on the driveway in front of Osborne's main house in Little Rock, and it was all red lights for that to happen. And Osborne would stand out on the curb handing out free Christmas canes to people who had stopped by to see the lights. I talked with one person when I was working at Walt Disney World who had been in Arkansas when the lights were on, and he said they weren't Christmas canes, they were Christmas logs. They were these huge round sticks, and he would just, you know, his favorite Osborne's favorite expression was random act of kindness. Which we should all be doing random acts of kindness. That, you know, and that if you've been blessed with a good life, if you've been blessed with money, it also that blessing comes with a responsibility to share with others. And I think that's one of the important things. Other than, my gosh, what a wonderful spectacle! I think that thought and that spirit was one of the souvenirs you take away from the Disney experience of how you can really transform people's lives and make them better, because this is a tough life, you know, and none of us are getting out of it alive. We might as well spend the time that we have here, you know, when we can, to help each other. And certainly that's very much in the spirit of the Christmas season.
Well, and I think too, you know, I want to make sure we really talk about Jennings Osborne himself, because the things he did, from handing out candy canes to decorating, look, the thing he did at his home, he did for his only daughter, right? It was something that he did mm-hmm. for her. And, you know, his wife had multiple miscarriages. So it meant a lot to him. And when he did things at his home, when he did things here at Disney, it was purely philanthropic. He had no ulterior motives. He was not trying to promote or sell or advertise a company or a business. You know, he was a biologist, like a microbiologist, and he did prescription drug testing. That's where he made his money, but he never did anything for any other purpose. He didn't want it to be sponsored by or brought to you by. This was not really about him. It was very philanthropic in terms of wanting to share what he had created for his daughter with other people as well.
Well, I got to talk with John Phelan, and one of the things Phelan did was he got a Walt Disney World cast member name badge made up for Osborne. But he said one of the things that impressed him most is 1 year they were standing and they were looking at all the lights, and Osborne looked at him and he says, "I just like making people happy."
Yeah.
And his great joy was, you know, he didn't want to be recognized. He didn't want, you know, a big spotlight on him when he turned on the lights, you know, each year or something like that. He just liked to see people out there enjoying it. You know,
right? He wasn't trying to be Matthew Broderick and Danny DeVito in Deck the Halls, trying to see if he could lights be seen by space,
or Clark Griswold. You know,
although like Clark Griswold, he actually blew transformers in his neighborhood. They assigned him, the power company gave him his own transformers because he blew the lights.
And Disney ran into some of those same challenges in those early years over here because a lot of those lights, now eventually they got changed out into LED lights and, you know, things like that. But the original sets were just Christmas tree lights that you would buy at a Home Depot or a Walmart. And then a lot of these cords were just, you know, extension cords clicked together, you know, for crying out loud. But, you know, sometimes that's all it takes. You know, the electrical water pageant, that's all it was. It's these flat wire screens, but the lights aren't these big fancy, they were just regular Christmas tree lights to begin with. You know, and then you synchronize them for that to happen. Sometimes the simplest things are the best. One of Walt's favorite Christmas gifts was given to him by the studio nurse, Hazel George, went to a dime store like Woolworth's or Crest or Newberry's, and those are names people probably don't remember anymore. but bought a little a dime store kaleidoscope, and Walt was just enthralled because you could look through it, and as you turned it changed shapes and was never the same shape twice, and he kept it on his desk, and that Christmas season, anybody who came in to visit Walt had them pick up the kaleidoscope and hold it up, and, you know, woe to you if you were not half as excited as Walt
and kids.
Was.
Kids who, if you don't know what a kaleidoscope is, it's kind of like...
Oh, gosh, yeah, they probably don't even know
it's
that.
It's kind of all like right, Oculus so Rift or virtual reality, but not quite as detailed.
Listen. When the zombie apocalypse comes and all the electricity is gone, we'll be going back to this stuff, boy.
Exactly. So, all right. So I want to just quickly touch on, you know, we mentioned how 2015/2016 season, the Osborne lights went away, and a lot of people were very upset, but I think still are. And
we all thought that, well, maybe they'll bring them back to Disney Springs, or maybe they'll. I heard rumors too that they were going over to the Magic Kingdom and all of that. Obviously, those at this particular point have proven untrue. So what can you possibly have to replace this with?
So just to be clear, because I think Disney got a lot of negative PR, and believe it or not, there are some angry people on Twitter who were just incensed at Disney for taking this away. Understand, first of all, that 2015 just happens to be the 20th anniversary. This was a 20-year contract. It was actually 5-year contracts that were renewed multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, now we know that the studios, we see it's already happening, that plane is very much in flight. They knew that the Streets of America was obviously going away. So the time had come. They literally could not renew that 5-year contract. Look, like Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Heroes, I know nothing, but talk about references that nobody's going to get. I know nothing,
no.
But I do think that something else is coming. I think that we have not seen the last of lights that will be synchronized to music. They will probably not be Osborne lights because now they're, you know, they can sort of do it on their own. I think we see where technology is going.
Well,
I
haven't seen this new drone show over at Disney Springs.
It's spectacular.
But those people who have told me, Jim, it's pretty amazing, you know, and watching it on YouTube is really a very weak representation.
You're doing yourself
a
disservice.
There.
I saw it on the first night, and I know some of the people who were involved in the project, and they're like, look, it was okay. Like, the first night was, I am not too much of a man to admit, I was brought to tears. Like, there were moments in it. I was choked
somebody
up.
Somebody was stepping on your foot while you were sitting there.
I was hungry. I was just really, really hungry. But
okay.
The way that they, it was a ballet. It was this beautiful ballet set to music and something we had never, ever seen before. We are going to look back on November of 2016 and say, remember that first time that they did the drone show in the sky? And now that we see it in other parts, again, knowing nothing, I think you are going to see this brought into places like Pandora, where the bioluminescent, you know, environment really comes to life, not just on the ground and not just...
I think that would be a good
absolutely.
Guess, yes.
But I also think that you will see dancing light in some form or fashion returning to the Walt Disney World theme parks. I think potentially, again, if you want to have this idea and sort of going back to what Jennings Osborne did, it was something for his neighbors to come and see. Well, where is a neighborhood in Walt Disney World? Main Street USA, according to story, it is a neighborhood. You could have that there. It would be a nice potential complement to the castle projection show. Imagine what it would be like with the snow falling on Main Street in that intimate type of environment, much like Streets of America was. There may be other places it could happen as well, but I do think it will come back, just not necessarily in the Osborne name.
Well, I think the point here is there are things that need to be kept in the spirit. Technology will change, you know, and there are times where things will just go. I'm one of the worst offenders. I tell people to, you know, really pay attention and take pictures and all that. There are many times we talked off mic about the Jolly Holidays dinner show where I thought, oh, this will always be here. Mm-hmm. This is so magnificent. This is making a ton of money. This will always be here. No, it's not. You know, it's gone. And, you know, it's the same thing with animation. There are people who complain that, you know, well, animation, you know, the only true animation, it's done, you know, with a pencil and, you know, 24 frames per second, and you have to hand paint, you know, the cells, you know. But, you know, technology changes. And now that we have computers that can do things in animation that people could not even imagine, you know, in the 1940s when they were doing this. But it has to be in service of a good story.
Right.
You know, it has to be in service of a solid story. When people take a look at Pixar, I think an awful lot of times they take a look at the technology. Oh, look, they got hair that can move. They've got water that looks like real water. What makes those pictures memorable are the stories and the characters. And I think with out here at Walt Disney World for the theme parks, when it comes to new things, and especially at Christmas, it's like there's going to be new technology, things that are undreamt of at this particular moment, and they'll be put into service, but they need to be put into service to support that original basic foundation, that spirit of Christmas and what that's all about, of, you know, goodwill to men, you know, peace on earth, you know, family,
good food,
love, giving, you know, that, and if they do that, then that's going to work, and there's going to be a whole new tradition, and for those people who mourn the loss of the Festival of Lights, and I do as well, you have to realize that for the first 20 years of Walt Disney World, that didn't exist. It wasn't there, you know. As you can mourn the loss of this, but you should also take a moment to appreciate that it was there at all.
Right.
And that it was there for an extended period of time.
Well, as long as we're talking about lights and something that people missed, I think maybe this is an easy, good segue to another light show that I think people were and still are sad to see gone. It was one that began back in 94, lasted to about 2008, 2009, and it was the old Lights of Winter that took place in the...
I missed that. Yes.
Yeah.
Go
so
ahead.
In the walkway in between Future World and World Showcase was this archway lighted with 30,000-40,000. These were the old school. These were the original dancing lights you know, the Osmond lights came in. They were here, like I said, till 2000. I don't know if it was 2008, 2009.
Yeah, I think it's 2009.
Yeah. So maybe January 2009, somewhere around there. Again, it was an older technology.
No, 2009 was the year that they didn't install them.
Okay. So, yeah, right.
2008 was the last year. We want to be accurate because people tune in to this podcast figuring that they're not just getting those rumors. They're getting, you know, the real thing, the straight skinny here.
2008, so, 2009, yeah. Whatever it takes from, like, Mr. Mom. But again, it was... It was, love Michael Keaton. It was one of those things where they necessarily couldn't replace all the lights and the technology. You know, it was something that was a lot older. I don't necessarily think that we won't see something like that maybe in Epcot again, but I think people miss it because of the memories that they have of walking through those archways from World Showcase to Future World and vice versa.
And again, an experience that you can't get anywhere else other than at a Disney theme park. And, you know, again, I've used the word immersive many times in this podcast, but it truly is. You're walking and you're underneath these towering archways. And again, the lights are simplistic, but you know, there's patterns, there's colors. Sometimes it would just go all white, you know, and it's dark out there. You know, you really don't have any ambient light, and it's like, wow, you know, what a memory, you know, what a memory.
All right, so let's just talk about some. Well, let's stay in the parks for a second because I want to go over to some of the resorts about some of the other things that have come and gone, and I'm saying them because I want to see if this may prompt the memory or recollection of somebody going, yeah, but I remember being in Epcot in like 1986 and seeing Carol Lawrence. Well, you did. Carol Lawrence and the World Dancers performed the Holiday Splendor Show at the America's Gardens by the Shore Pavilion. I think just that one year. There was a sparkling Christmas show in 1991 that became the Sparkling Christmas Spectacular on the Cinderella Castle stage. That was a very big...
Listen, let's go back to 1984.
And I think you want to go back to Carol Lawrence.
Frontierland, and you've got, you know, Liverlips McGraw dressed up as Elvis Presley with a Christmas tree guitar and Teddy Barra in ski gear and a cast on her leg, you know? I'm going to climb up there and sign her cast there. Big Al dressed as Baby New Year. The Country Bear Jamboree Christmas Special.
Which, I have to tell you, I dug that. Like the original Country Bear, it was corny and cheesy and campy, but I loved, and I think maybe this was part of the problem, but I loved seeing these bears perform traditional Christmas songs like Sleigh Ride and Blue Christmas and Winter, all of sort of the standards that we know today, although my kids would say, what are you talking about?
Blue Christmas, Sleigh Ride, yeah. Winter Wonderland, all of those were and again, to me, it just made the characters more real because, no, this isn't just an attraction. These just aren't audio animatronic heavy pieces of machinery. These are real characters because they're celebrating Christmas. And not only are they celebrating Christmas, not only is there the superficial change of costumes, they're actually singing, you know, these songs. And you got Buff the Buffalo on the wall wearing his Santa Claus hat and the deer with the red light bulb on his nose like Rudolph and the moose with Christmas trees on the antler. And it was like, Yeah, these are my old buddies, and I'm going to a Christmas party at their house here. You know?
Well, the same way they used to do their
again,
vacation hoedown, right? These were like, you know, real people. These were like real performers.
Real bears.
Right.
real characters. But again, the official Walt Disney World statement is that the reason they don't do that anymore, they stopped, last time they did that was 2006. The reason they don't do that anymore, and the reason that we don't get Nightmare Before Christmas out here, it's not a question of money, it's a question of we have a different makeup of guests.
Right.
That at Disneyland, what you're having is you're having a lot of annual pass holders, a lot of locals. And so in order to bring them in, you need to have something different. But at Walt Disney World, primarily our guests are more international, you know, and are not locals. You know, they may come from the Midwest or whatever, you know, for their week of Christmas celebration. And so they would be disappointed if they did not see the traditional attractions.
And I
or
think that makes sense.
Or if they came out and the attractions were down for
right.
the makeover. You
right.
know?
People forget that the Nightmare Before Christmas overlay at Disneyland doesn't happen overnight. I mean, it takes months for it to happen. And if you do save up for 5 years to go to Walt Disney World and your kid's been dying to see the Haunted Mansion and it's closed to become something that is overlaid with a movie that maybe they haven't seen before, it could very much be disappointing to them.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know whether I completely buy into that. But again, I do buy into the fact that, you know, Disney is a business. You know, it's show business. And the business has to be successful in order for the show to go on. I get that. But it still doesn't prevent me from going, I want to see them up there. And what was it? The penguin in the block of ice shaking during when they were singing Blue Christmas.
Of the things that I actually miss the most, and this is surprising for me, and I don't know why I keep thinking back to this, because I'm not normally somebody that you know, when I go to the parks, will sit down and watch a show, but I really used to like the old the Mickey's Twas the Night Before Christmas show at the old Tomorrowland stage, which is now the Buzz Lightyear meet and greet.
Yeah, the Nutcracker show, too, they had and all
right,
that,
and,
yeah.
And because you had Mickey and Santa Goofy and Chip and Dale and the soldiers, and it was one of the things that I used to enjoy. And if you've never been to the Tomorrowland stage, you used to be able to see it from the Wedway People Mover, but it now is blocked off. That area is blocked off by where the Buzz Lightyear meet and greet is in between Buzz and Carousel of Progress. There used to be sort of, for lack of a better word, metal park benches and a stage at the far end.
Yeah.
And that's where the Twas the Night Before. And it was a long show. It was like a half-hour long show.
Yeah, yeah. In those days, shows ran half-hour. And then Disney determined that shows needed to run closer to 15, no more than 20 minutes, because people were rushing. Because now, going to Walt Disney World, it's an appointment vacation. You know, oh, here's my fast pass. Oh,
right.
here's my reservation for, to eat. So it's an appointment vacation. But in those days, and don't forget, there was also a stage. A lot of people forget this. There was also a stage in Fantasyland, beyond the carousel, over by where the 20,000 Leagues attraction was, just over to the left of that, between that and Pinocchio's Village House, there was a Fantasyland stage, and they did little character shows there. And I love those. You know, it's like, yes, Minnie is having a Christmas get-together, and the Country Bears are coming in from outdoors, and Chip and Dale are coming down the chimney, and yeah, a nice short little show. But yeah, they're all dressed up in their Christmas finery. There's some, and you really feel, yeah, this is the holidays. I'm a huge supporter of Disney entertainment. I will tell you the one thing that really miss in terms of entertainment at Magic Kingdom was the Kids of the Kingdom.
Yeah.
I know it was Disney's version of Up with People, but Kids of the Kingdom, I love that, you know. And when the Disney MGM Studios opened, they had the I think they were called the Girls of Hollywood. So there were these beautiful, beautiful young women with legs that went on forever, and they would do Hollywood classic Hollywood show tunes. So again, they immediately had my heart because I love old movies. And they did it on that stage, which is now where Sunset Boulevard is, you know. So Disney is constantly changing. So what people need to remember from this podcast is, you know, appreciate what is there now. Really enjoy it. Don't take it for granted, you know. And if you're – and I don't think you should live your life trying to take pictures of it with your phone and all of that, you know.
See it with your own eyes.
You should do that occasionally, but take the memories with you, the experience with you, you know. Because even as you and I are talking about some of these things, Lou, I find myself just smiling because I can remember the colors. I can, you know, remember some of the sounds. I can remember, you know, how I was feeling and how exciting it was to be at Walt Disney at Christmas.
Yeah. And I agree with you. And it's often disappointing for me to see when I watch a show, especially at night, and you are bathed in a sea of glowing blue lights from people's phones because they're recording. And I get it. We want to record it. We want to share it.
What's worse for me is they're holding them up over their head.
Right.
So I can't see the
We used to put our kids on our shoulders. Now we put our phones up in the air. So, and look, I'm guilty of it too. I understand. I like to live broadcast because I like to bring people the experience if they can't get there. But, you know, mm-hmm. something that you said, Jim, too, is I think it's not only necessarily looking at these things with your own eyes, but sometimes some of the smallest details, it doesn't have to be a grand production and stage show. So one of the things that I remember, and kids, there was a time way back when there was no sorcerer hat in the middle of the Disney MGM studios. It was actually at one point they put up a Christmas tree. And do you remember when they used to have the train set, the old of Hollywood themed train set that would go around under the tree, and it had the Hollywood Bowl and the Hollywood mm-hmm. Hills amphitheater and a tiny little miniature Chinese theater, which sat in the shadow of the really big, one-to-one scale Chinese theater.
I had forgotten about that train set until you just brought that up. And it was always one of my favorites to go, because again, it's that attention to detail. It's that little sense of whimsy and humor, with that. And gosh.
Well, okay. So
this is the Rip Van Winkle show. Is this it? We fell asleep 50 years ago and just woke up to do this podcast.
No, I'm hoping that somebody's going, but wait, Lou, I remember this train at the studios. You're not crazy because it was there. And if you're going, Lou, wasn't there a time that there was like the big fake water tower and they put a giant Santa hat on it, like mm-hmm. around, right, the old Earful Tower, which is not there anymore. I think 2016,
oh, gosh.
The Earful Tower went away.
It's all going faster than I know. It's like
keep track
dominoes,
of the dates.
Bing, 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 bing. A lot faster than I care to imagine. I hope that there are some listeners who not only go, yes, I remember that, and I wish you guys had talked about
this, right?
Such and such. But I hope there are some people who go, I never heard about that. I wonder if we can do something like that again.
So just a couple of things that are no longer there that I wanted to mention because maybe we'll see another incarnation of it, or maybe it's something that you remember. So Jim, I think that you touched on it earlier. Was a dinner show that they had in the mid to late 80s over at the Contemporary in the
those
Fantasia
Ballroom. Jolly, jolly, jolly holidays. Those holly, 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 jolly days. Yes. Oh,
there you go. At the old Holiday Village, which was the Fantasia Ballroom. And it was the Jolly Holiday. It was a dinner. Disney was always big on dinner shows. And this was
a theater in the round setting. You had that big, huge stage in the center, and you had tables around. And then there were sort of satellite small stages, annex stages around there. And so very much similar to like Hoop-Dee-Doo Review, whatever. But the premise here is that you're being invited to the Holiday Village, where Papa, this lovable old gray-bearded character, has invited people over, and there's going to be singing, there's going to be performing, and there's going to be all you can eat, which basically is the server comes to you and goes, that's all you can eat. And because the next song is coming now, Santa Goofy is coming out with Pluto dressed up as a reindeer, or the hippos and ostriches from Fantasia are coming out and doing a dance to the Nutcracker's suite, or all of that. So again, and again, massive show at least 100 performers, as I recall,
and characters, and there
they
was
would
characters,
do two
right?
shows a night.
Hmm? There was it wasn't just performers, but there was characters in there as well.
Oh, yes, yes. And so, you know, I thought, I went to it twice. And again, it was pricey. But and I remember one year thinking, well, no, I've seen this and I enjoy that, but you know, finances are a little tight this year. I'll go next year, and there was no next year. Let that be a warning. That's the voice of Christmas past warning you. You know, there may not be a next year.
So,
you know, but we also forget that there was all sorts of little things right. going on all around property. You know, when I came out in the fall of 1995, my brother Mike was a performer at Disney MGM Studios. He was the Rawhide Kid, and he'd twirl this massive rope and all that. But he also did, you know, convention shows and all that. And one of the gigs that he got was over at Port Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Port Orleans, and they would do an hour and a half little Christmas presentation. This is one of those hidden secrets. I know this happened. I was there. I've even got some video of this, but it'll be interesting to see if any of the listeners remember this as well. But in that little courtyard out there, you could get a free cider and a sugar cookie, only one sugar cookie, because I know I tried to get more than one. You can only get one sugar cookie. And there would be this little 15-minute show where there'd be a jester, you know, a Mardi Gras jester, and that was my brother. And sometimes they'd have a little three-piece band or whatever, and he'd juggle, and he'd do some tricks, and he'd make a balloon animal or two or whatever. And then he would lead. He had this a single long candle. He would lead them out into an area by the pool, just over towards the right. It was this flat, grassy area. I don't know what it is now. And he would tell them the story of the Noel candle, which is a French story about you leave a small candle burning in the window on the eve of Noel to light the way for the Christ child. And then they would pass out handouts of Christmas carols, and the jester would lead people in the singing of the carols. And it was a nice, you know, little intimate ceremony. And again, usually you had a crowd of, you know, maybe 25, 35 people. And I remember thinking at the time, Disney is spending all of this money and taking all of this time just for like 25, 35 people. Yes, they were. And what a nice little heartwarming experience. So, of course, since it was a nice heartwarming little experience that only appealed to 25, 35 people, you know, a night, boing, that went. But I'll bet there were other things like that out there, and my gosh, you know, we haven't even touched on the decorations. You've been to the Holiday Services Building, right, Lou?
I have, and I just want to go back real quick about the Port Orleans thing, because I don't remember seeing it in with my own eyes, but when you said something, was that ever on one of the?
Yes, in 1991.
I was
going to
say DVDs, but probably it was a videotape. Was it on the Betamax? Was it on the Betamax back then?
Only sold at Walt Disney World. Yeah, it was Walt Disney World Christmas. It had little clips of...
Right.
And that was my brother, by golly. That was my brother, Mike, who still works for Disney.
Was it really?
In entertainment. So.
But see, I like the fact that that was something that was not advertised. It wasn't an attraction. That was a gift, I think.
You discovered it on your own.
But right, it was a gift to the people who were staying there. It was something special for the people who were staying there. Look, we all go to the different resorts now to see the gingerbread houses. Many of us, especially who are locals, will make a special trip out to Fort Wilderness to see the decorations or do one of the sleigh rides. But I think that the Port Orleans...
Or go see the holiday storytellers at Epcot.
Exactly.
World Showcase.
Exactly. So I like that. I like that a lot. Something else that people may or may not remember was the holiday celebrations and little treats like this were not just limited to the parks and the resorts. They also took place in Downtown Disney / Disney Village Marketplace / Lake Buena Vista Village. Call it what you want. And one of the ones that I remember seeing, it had to have been late 80s, early 90s, was at, I guess maybe it was called the Marketplace then, was it really was sort of a living nativity scene, which was the glory and pageantry of Christmas.
A tableau, yes. Oh my gosh, and I remember it drove people crazy because cars would be backed up bumper to bumper on Lake Buena Vista, trying to get there, even though there were, I think, at least two shows an evening. But yeah, you're right. It was late 80s, early 90s, and it was called the Glory and Pageantry of Christmas. And originally it was performed at the Captain's Tower, which was a stage area. It's now Pin Traders. And then it moved to the waterfront dock stage because, again, the whole concept was you're having more people, you've got to accommodate, more people. And the whole point of this was that people weren't going down, to the Village Marketplace. It seemed to be like on the fringes of Disney. So you wanted to do something to, especially over the Christmas season, bring people in so that they would buy things in the shops. And the shops were, the exteriors at least, the facades were decorated, to suggest a little town like Little Town of Bethlehem. And then you had a narrator, and you had these actors, and there were Christmas songs as well. But basically, the big finale, the big finish, is Mary and Joseph approach the manger, which is on stage, and the shepherds appear, and then the angels appear. They rise up from behind the manger, and we're talking about two or three dozen performers here. And then the big punchline, the big finale, was the various shopkeepers would bring out items from their shop to give to the Christ child, where at the same time, advertising, yes, you should go to that candle shop. Mm-hmm. If you like that candle being given to that little baby there, you should go to this candle shop. We have these on sale. And then, as I said, the punchline is a little orphan boy comes up and he has no gift to bring. And so Mary encourages him to play his drum. So you've got, the little drummer boy playing. And so, again, very respectful, very... again, in many of the Disney shows, as part of the audience, you become part of that experience because you're seeing the reaction on other people, not just children, but on adults that, emotional triggers are being set off, and you're going through this, and it's just a wonderful reminder, of the season. And I've often wondered if, because it was so religiously oriented, whether that had any impact on it fading away into history. Probably it was more realistic that, all of these people came to see the show, but then they didn't stick around to go shop in the shop.
But I did love the fact that they incorporated the surrounding shopkeeping. Because, look, remembering back to the 80s, it really was, it had much more of a village type feel to it. And I know we have talked in the past about sort of the history of the marketplace itself and what it was and what it eventually became. But it did have that sort of neighborhood village type feel, and I love
it. It was a nice intimate experience, and it didn't have the hustle and bustle of the parks, and again there was no admission fee, so if you wanted to meet somebody and they didn't have a ticket to get into the parks or whatever, this was a wonderful place to meet. Or if you wanted to buy, you know, a Disney park item, here was a place that you could go. Although, especially in the beginning, there were a lot of shops that were not themed specifically to Disney, but to, as I mentioned, things like candles or perfume or whatever.
We were joking before about the kaleidoscope on Walt's desk. I have to tell you, man, as we were talking back about the old village, I used to love the giant kaleidoscope that was right over there by the, it's sort of by where the entrance to World of, where the Stitch side entrance, where Stitch is spinning, right in that courtyard there, was where the giant kaleidoscope was.
Mm-hmm. And now they have it's a meet and greet area for Santa out there, or was. I don't know if it is this year. Things constantly change. But yeah, that that kaleidoscope. Oftentimes there were things placed in a Disney theme park where, no, it wasn't, as you pointed out, wasn't on the map. It wasn't a timed experience. You just stumbled across it in a sense of discovery, and it's like, oh, isn't this neat? This is here.
I remember,
you know, what is
Jim,
this?
I remember, oh my God, I get choked up. I remember being with my mom and my dad and wanting to just look. I was fascinated by this simple, and we say giant kaleidoscope, we mean one that stood 30, 40 feet in the air. I mean, it was, it was huge, and you sort of look down onto the sort of these plates on the bottom, and when the sun shone in, it was, I thought it was beautiful, and I was, one of the things I was sad to see when it left. But you mentioned Santa Claus, and we would be remiss. We was nice segue, right? We would be remiss if we did not mention Santa Claus, who is very, very busy this time of year, and he bounces around from parks to parks. But back in the 70s, you could not only meet Santa Claus and take pictures with Santa Claus, but more importantly, Jimmy Korkus, you could have breakfast with Santa on the Empress Lily.
I never got a chance to do that. No.
So I didn't. I don't ever remember doing it. But back in December of 77, while you were still excited about, you know, Star Wars having come out just a few months earlier, if you thought that was good, you could have breakfast with Santa. And this, if you like character meals now, not only should you thank Santa Claus, but you should thank Disney Springs and Downtown Disney. More importantly, thank Mr. George Kalogridis, because he is the person that came up with, obviously collectively part of a team, but came up with this idea of having breakfast with Santa. So the Empress Lily was only open for lunch or dinner. You said before they're trying to find a way to get people down into this Disney World Village or the Disney Village Marketplace.
Village Marketplace, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they have this idea to come up with this, to let people and families come in earlier in the day to do their Christmas shopping and browsing, but to kick off the day by having breakfast with Santa and friends aboard the Empress Lily. It obviously became super popular. Resort visitors are going over there to do it. So they're like, well, wait a minute, maybe we're onto something here. And this sort of was the catalyst for what we now know as character dining at other resort locations. Like, remember, we were talking about the Country Bear Jamboree. Melvin the Moose, the Melvin the Moose breakfast at Fort Wilderness, and Minnie's Menahune over at the Polynesian. All those things came from this initial, the first character, this should have been this week's trivia question. The first character meal at Walt Disney World was with Santa Claus.
And where I thought you were heading, that's why it's always so exciting for me to do these podcasts with you, is because we bounce these ideas back and forth. We've had similar experiences, but we've had different experiences. When you were saying not only Santa Claus, I thought you were going for, in the early days, they had not only Santa Claus, they had Frosty the Snowman, because some kids are scared of Santa Claus. And I will tell you, back out in California, I was a friend of Santa Claus's. And one of
Wait,
the first
they're
things,
scared of Santa Claus.
One of the first things you learn as Santa Claus is you've got to put on the rubber pants. And I thought, why are they having me put on rubber pants?
Jim, I think that was I think
Nobody's
that they were
see rubber pants.
I think they were concerned more about you than they were the children.
The first 5 minutes I was out there, and a screaming, yelling child being forced into Santa's lap there, and losing all control of his bodily functions, I was thankful for rubber pants. So all future friends of Santa, remember to, you know, check
always wear your
before
rubber
you go
pants
on stage.
Yeah, so they weren't scared of, they were scared of Santa, but they weren't scared of the giant talking fat snowman. That there's nothing.
No, listen, I would have been more scared of a giant talking snowman, for crying out loud, you know, because I had known snowmen. I had made snowmen.
Right.
You know, having one come to life, that's like, you know, oh no, what's wrong? It's the end of the world.
So, and the last thing that I found in my due diligence, which I don't ever remember seeing with my own eyes, was you may have seen pictures of a giant hot air balloon shaped like Mickey Mouse that they brought out in the 80s.
Yes.
He was known as Air Force One, but in December of around the holiday season, when they gave him, like the water tower, a giant Santa Claus hat, he became
Knew that.
He was Cheer Force One.
Ha! Huh.
He was Cheer Force One.
See, there's always something new to learn.
There you go. But I'm sure.
You know, but all of your listeners, they're going to go out and they're going to tell their friends and family, and their friends and family are going, oh my gosh, you just know everything. You're just such an expert. No, I never saw Mickey. I've never even seen a photo of Air Force One with a Santa's cap. But again, it makes absolute logical sense.
So did
we need to bring that back? Bring back Air Force One. Come on.
So is there anything else that you think we missed? I mean, and the point was, and I'm sure we have missed something along the way.
I think the most important thing is that we've missed is giving the listeners all of our sizes and color preferences. and there's just too many Disney things to put on a Disney Christmas list. Just books alone. I take a look at that, and it seems like a new Disney book is coming out every single week, and it's a Disney book that I would want to have in my own personal library.
Well, I will tell you, I'm going to tell you what's on my Christmas list for anybody that's listening. Yeah, so my Christmas list really sort of consists of things like Secret Stories of Walt Disney World by Jim Corcus, the unofficial Disneyland 1955 companion by Jim Corcus, All the Vaults of Walt by Jim Corcus, Walt's Words by Jim Corcus, Cartoon Confidential by Jim Corcus. What else am I missing? Is it 15 books?
Gosh, animation, anecdotes, everything I know I learned from Disney animated feature films. How to be a Disney historian, and not only will they make you happy for Christmas, but you getting them will make me happy. Not just because I'll be able to pay my electric and gas bill, but because it'll make me happy because you will have all of these wonderful stories to share with other people, and I took great delight in hearing Lou share the Charlton Heston and the John Wayne stories that I've included in the books there, because stories are living things and they need to be told to be kept alive, and if we don't, then we forget these things and they die or they morph into something different, and one of the reasons I write all of these books is not, you know, just to pay the gas bill and, you know, gosh, I need a filling in my tooth. But I got a chance to meet a lot of Imagineers and animators, and they told me so many wonderful things, and unfortunately, they're no longer around, you know, this holiday season to enjoy it. And it's important to have their stories out there and shared with others. And while you're picking up my books, don't forget to pick up Lou Mangello's books as well, and his CD set, and heaven only knows what else he has. Make sure you always check the shop at WDW Radio. You never know, one of these days when a Vinylmation Lou may pop up, you know, or a limited edition Cloisonne WDW Radio pin. Do you even have those, or and I miss those, or
we did? I haven't had them in a long time. Maybe it's something I have to bring back. But listen, I want people. Listen, I really, and I mean this sincerely. You know, I am Jim Corcus's number one fan. If you don't believe me, come check out the shrine at my house. But if you go and visit wdwradio.com/Corcus, K-O-R-K-I-S, I want to make it as easy for you as possible to pick up not one, not two, but as many of the Jim Corcus books. They are wonderful. You do such, and I know this is like the Mutual Admiration Society, but you do such an amazing job, Jim, of keeping the legacy and the stories and the magic alive of the history of these parks, which I think is so, so very important. And you are and continue to be a fascinating story. And I am so grateful to you and for you that you come on and share these stories in your own words and in your own voice with our friends here who are listening. We've got to do this again because there are many, many stories which we haven't gotten to
yet. I'm going to be interested in reading the listener comments to see holiday memories that, you know, we may have missed, or holiday memories where we brought back a memory. And by the way, Lou, I have great respect for Lou. Lou wrote the foreword to Vault of Walt Volume 2. So it one of my favorite volumes, so very much respect that. And again, you know, this is the WDW Radio Christmas holiday gift to all of you this year. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you so much, Jim. It was really great to look at the past, the history of Christmas at Walt Disney World. It'll be interesting to see, and we're going to talk in upcoming shows about what the present and the future is going to be. But again, find Jim's books at wdwradio.com/Corcus, K-O-R-K-I-S. Thank you so very much, my friend. And as always, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Favorite Christmas movie, go.
Favorite what movie?
Christmas movie.
Oh, I like Miracle on 34th Street, the original one with Edmund Gwenn.
Favorite thing to eat at Christmas time? This is like lightning round. I'm making it up as I go along.
This is that dark chocolate ball that when you it also has orange in it, and you smash it so that in it falls out into those separate little slices.
Favorite or most memorable Christmas gift you ever received?
Oh, gosh, there were so many. But I would say that back when I was a kid living in Glendale, one Christmas, Mom and Dad went to Disneyland, and at the art corner, they got me the Art of Animation kit, which had a How to Draw Mickey book, How to Draw Donald book, How to Do Animation, and a little press board animation table with glass and some pre-punched paper so they could be put on pegs so I could become an animator. And I never did. But I loved getting the gift.
All right, last question, because I will tell you, I'll let you in on a little secret. I love Christmas, but I don't necessarily like getting presents on Christmas.
You and me both.
Maybe this is my dad rubbing off. Dad was, in many ways, my dad was Santa Claus, and I think he, like I, gets more joy in giving gifts than we do receiving them. So what's the favorite gift that you ever gave?
Actually, it's not the gift that I gave. It's the gift that my father gave, and it's just embedded in my memory. Is every Christmas Eve in Glendale, we would invite over, of course, friends and family, and especially those people who were away from their friends and family, so they had nowhere else to go. And Dad would go to See's Chocolate and get those pre-wrapped 1 pound boxes. And so they're in that holiday thing with the ribbon on it, and they'd have a little sticker, and Dad would stick them in the refrigerator so that if somebody dropped by and they happened to have brought a friend, you know, or a plus one and all of that, Dad would go to the refrigerator, pull it out, and write the person's name on it, and it's from Santa and the Korkus family, and he would slip it under the tree. And so on Christmas Eve, we would pass out the presents. And so here's this person who maybe, you know, 20 minutes, a half hour before, had no intention of ever coming to the Korkus house, and underneath the tree, a present is being pulled out, and it says, you know, to Tracy from Santa and the Korkus family. And the look on that person's face, and I just remembered that, that you should always give unexpected gifts, and that it takes so little to really make people, you know, just so happy. So when you talk about giving gifts, that's the very first image that always comes to my mind.
I love it. It truly is more important to give than to receive. And if you, my friend, the listener, want to share your story about the greatest, the gift that you, the most memorable gift you ever received, or the most memorable gift you ever gave, or your best Disney memory of the holidays, go to facebook.com/WDW Radio. You can leave it there. Better yet, I'd love to hear it. Call the voicemail at 407-900-9391. That's 407-900-WDW1, and I will play it on the air. Little Jimmy Korkus, my Jolly Jimmy Korkus, my friend.
Jolly Jimmy Korkus.
Jolly Jimmy.
over the holiday season, I am not little at all, and certainly not little in holiday spirit.
Well, have a very stretchy pants Christmas.
Thank you so much.
It's time for our Walt Disney World trivia question of the week, where I invite you to test your knowledge of Walt Disney World history or see how well you pay attention to the details, not just in what you see, but sometimes in what you hear. If you think you know the answer, you can enter via email or our online form for a chance to win a Disney prize package. Before we get to this week's question, we're going to go back, review last week's, and select our winner. So this week we're talking about Christmas, but last week's question was about Thanksgiving in Walt Disney World. More importantly, some of the history that can be found in and around Liberty Square in the Magic Kingdom. And the question that I had for you was to tell me, what was the name of the ceremony that took place in Liberty Square in the 70s in front of the Liberty Bell, involving the Fife and Drum Corps and the Revolutionary Era costuming, and the selection of a boy and a girl from the crowd who would participate and get a special prize. Again, thanks to the hundreds of you who entered, got this one correct. Some of you shared pictures of the parade or you being selected for the ceremony and as one of the sons and daughters of Liberty. And that's exactly what we were looking for. Some of you remember Ben Franklin leading the Liberty Square Fife and Drum Corps throughout Liberty Square, selecting a son or daughter of Liberty from the crowd who was given a special medal or a badge, a copy of the Declaration of Independence, sometimes a tri-corner hat. I took all the correct entries, randomly selected one, and again, last week you were playing for the 102 Ways to Save Money for an At Walt Disney World book, all 7 of my virtual audio walking tours of the Magic Kingdom, both of which you can find in the shop at www.radio.com. A WW Radio Magic Band cover, stickers, and a hot and cold travel mug. And last week's winner, an honorary member of the Sons and Daughters of Liberty, not really, is Lisa Navarez. So Lisa, you entered via the online form. I have all your shipping information. I will get your prize package out to you right away. But if you played last week and didn't win, that's okay. Thanksgiving was so last week. We're on to Christmas. And here's your next chance to enter in this week's Walt Disney World Trivia Challenge. So obviously this week we were talking a lot about the history of Christmas in Walt Disney World and some of the different celebrations and parades and even overlays that took place in some of the shows, like the Country Bears, when it converted to the Country Bear Christmas Special. In there, all the bears were dressed in their holiday best, and some were actually dressed in some unique costumes as well. And your question this week is to tell me, in the Country Bear Christmas Special, Big Al, one of my favorites, appeared dressed as what? And here's a bonus question for you this week. As long as we're talking about Christmas, let's bring it over out of the parks and into some animation. Name for me three Walt Disney animated feature films that open, begin, or end with a scene of Christmas. Three animated films that open or close, begin or end, with a scene of or about or at Christmas. Now, if you get the Country Bear Christmas Special Big Al question, you got the 102 Ways book, all the audio tours, a Magic Band cover, and stickers. If you get the bonus question, I will send you not only a WW Radio hot and cold travel mug, but I will also send you a WW Radio t-shirt as well. So if you use the form, be sure and include your size. So good luck, Merry Christmas, and have fun. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you again so much for taking time out of your day, your afternoon, your evening, your car ride, your treadmill, wherever you are. I sincerely, sincerely appreciate you. I know how valuable your time is, and I'm grateful that you choose to share and spend some of it with me. I'm thankful to and for you, as well as some of the new members of the WDW Radio Nation family, including Chelsea Lucas, Jennifer Kaufman, Bridget Cram, and Mike Masters. Thanks to you and everybody else who is part of the Nation family. If you want to help the show and get exclusive rewards every month, including scavenger hunts, access to our private Facebook group, personalized Magic Band covers, logo gear, t-shirts, monthly care packages from Walt Disney World, exclusive live video group calls, and lots more, please visit wdwradio.com/support. Again, it is completely optional, a great way for you to help and support the show. And also don't forget that a portion of your proceeds, of your contributions, will go to the Dream Team Project to benefit the Make-A-Wish Foundation of America. All right, a couple of quick announcements. The Purge is still going on, and by Purge, I mean the purge of items from my personal Disney, and coming up in the next few weeks, my Star Wars collection as well on eBay. If you visit wdwradio.com/eBay, auctions begin and end every Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern. There's everything from cast member materials to maps, books, documents, artwork, one-of-a-kind collectibles, and lots more. Again, visit wdwradio.com/eBay. Please don't forget that this show is not a one-way conversation. I would love to hear from you, chat with you on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest. I am at Lou Mangiello. Also, please like the page over at facebook.com/WW Radio. I've got some cool stuff working on specifically for Facebook coming up soon. If you have a question you want answered on the air, you can email me, lou@wwradio.com, or again, call the voicemail at 407-900-9391. And as I'm sure you've heard me say before, as much as I love connecting with you guys online and talking with you there, I think that nothing beats a handshake and a hug. I want the chance to meet and see and thank you in person. That's why I do Meet of the Month every month, coming on up on 10 years now in Walt Disney World. Our next Meet of the Month is going to be Wednesday, December 7th in the Magic Kingdom. Let's celebrate the holidays in the Magic Kingdom. We'll also combine it with a live broadcast. I do Facebook Live every Wednesday at facebook.com/WWRadio. So if you can't join us in the parks, please join us on Facebook. Be part of the get-together as we celebrate the holidays together. Again, go visit facebook.com/WDW Radio. Please RSVP. Let me know that you're coming. It is, of course, completely free. Anybody and everybody is welcome. Bring the whole family. It is obviously completely family-friendly. We'd love to see you there. It starts at 7 p.m. till about 8:30 or so. It is at the Tomorrowland Terrace, a.k.a. the Tomorrowland Noodle Station. Again, that's Wednesday, December 7th. Also, while you're on the events page, check out some of our other events coming up, including our double dip cruise to Castaway Key next year. We've got other special events coming in 2017 and beyond. Also, I'll be doing other events and meetups on the road as I travel to speak. And if I can come help speak to your business, your conference, or at your school, or if I can maybe help you turn what you love into what you do, please go and visit loumangiello.com. Thanks, as always, to my partners and sponsors, including Mouse Fan Travel, my official, my recommended travel provider, because it's who I have and will always continue to use, not just because of the discount prices that they give, but really it's about the level of personal service. They treat you like family, and it's all at no additional cost to you. And if you want some Disney magic delivered right to your door, or you want to give the gift of Celebrations Magazine, visit celebrationspress.com. And as always, my friends, and you are my friend, whether we have met yet or not, you continue to show that each and every week. And all I ask is that if you like the show, please help spread the word. Tell your friends that you're listening. Tweet out a link to this week's show. Better yet, share a link over on Facebook with your friends in a group or on a page. And if you can, take 30 seconds to rate and review the show over on iTunes. It's incredibly helpful. Thanks to you, we have more than 1,200 five-star reviews. Please keep them coming in. I want to thank some recent reviewers like Ellie Chilak, right, who says, fantastic Disney World planning. Lou does a fantastic job sharing the magic with those of us who can't currently be in Walt Disney World. They're wonderfully edited, entertaining, with contests, call-ins, and often talk of delicious food. He loves the positive and optimistic attitude that resonates with all of us in Disney fans. And he, actually you guys, have really created a community of like-minded people who believe that there is a great, big, beautiful tomorrow. Elichlack, even though I butchered your name, I agree with you 100%. Josh D has been listening for years, loves the show, and he says, I really like how Lou makes you feel like a friend, even if we've never met. You've got it, Josh, absolutely. And couldn't be happier, says JTK039. He says, Lou and his guests do a fantastic job of bestowing Disney magic on those who crave it in between visits. I've learned so much, been entertained thoroughly since discovering the show about a year ago. Here's to many more years of success, Lou. Thanks to you, JTK, and everybody else who has listened and reviewed the show. Again, if you visit www.radio.com/iTunes, it will give you an easy access to go over and review the show, as well as instructions on how to do it. And finally, and most importantly, my most humble and sincere gratitude goes out to you. I cannot express how much I appreciate the fact that you allow me to do what I do and share it with you each and every week. You are not a listener. You're not an audience member. You are not a statistic or a number to me. You really are more than just a friend, even though we've never met yet. You really are like family. And to quote one of my favorite characters and somebody who is wiser than he might appear, family isn't an important thing. It's everything. And I am grateful in this season of Thanksgiving and celebrating the holidays more than ever to you and for you, for nothing else than just taking the time to listen and for being part of my extended family. I hope that you have an amazing, incredible day. So until next time, see ya.
Hey, I'm calling in reference to the show 465, where you guys discussed some of the listener questions, and I never thought I'd call in because I figured you guys already had the chubby foodie thing nailed down. But when I heard you guys talking about Juno, I just had to call in. That's where my wife's family lives, and as much as we love Disney, Juno is still one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in person or in pictures. Her Majesty was talking about the crab legs. You guys ought to check out Timberline Barn Grill. Sometimes they have an all-you-can-eat crab legs, and it's just simply amazing. But that Tracy Arm excursion is well worth it, too. Just a beautiful place. And another visit that you guys have to make while you're there in town is that Red Dog Saloon. They still have Wyatt Earp's gun hanging there behind the bar. He had to check it in when he entered the bar, and as the legend goes, the marshals there in Juneau showed up while he was at the bar and escorted him out because of some of the bad press that he had gotten them. He wasn't much liked up in that part, but interesting history there. Enjoy your trip. The guy that called in asking the question, because I tell you what, Alaska's amazing. Have a great day.
Flying high, we're soaring to tomorrow. reaching out, the future's in our hands. The journey starts, the adventure never ending. The new frontier we face is the mystery of space. Destiny begins with you and me through all space and time. The achievement of mankind as we sail the sea of discovery. On hero's wings we fly. Big O Lou Mangiello, this is Luke Lawson from Bloomington, Indiana. Just wanted to give you a call, leaving my favorite song from Future World, Destiny from Mission Space. You introduced it to me once on a podcast, and I've loved it ever since. So keep up the good work, bud. We'll talk soon. Bye.
Hey, Lou, it's Chris at in West Palm Beach, Nick's team in the box. Just wanted to wish you, Deanne, Nick, and Marion, and the rest of your family, and everybody in the box, happy Thanksgiving. God bless. Enjoy your holiday. Talk to you soon. Take care, buddy.
Hey, how's it going, Lou? It's Brian Rainey again from Kansas City, Missouri. Just want to say it's been here 6 days. It's my last day. And I'm at Magic Kingdom right now. Just got off Splash Mountain. Just standing here on the bridge watching the boats go by. And try to squeeze one more ride in before I go to Magical Express. So I'm either going to do Pirates of the Caribbean or maybe Buzz Lightyear. But they're having a good trip. Went to STK Orlando down at Disney Springs the other night. Had one of the best steaks I've ever had. And the shakes at Deluxe Burger are really good, too. But did the Food and Wine Festival. There's so much to tell you, so much to talk about. I wish I could talk about it all. The Star Wars fireworks show at the studio is just amazing. Just got me all fired up for Star Wars. But anyway, it's my last day. That's it. And just want to leave everybody with this public service announcement. Please stand clear of the doors. Por favor, manténganse al lado de las puertas.
You've got a friend in me. Yeah.
Hi there, pal. It's me, Mickey. I wanted to call and wish you a Merry Christmas.
From all of us to all of you, a very Merry Christmas. Good night.
Save us, we need.